Well, good morning. As the kids make their migration back, if you have your Bible, open it up to Luke chapter 8. We're going to be finishing up Luke chapter 8 this morning. So we've been preaching through the Gospel of Luke, and we've talked about these accounts in this section being Luke trying to demonstrate the power and the authority of Jesus. And he does that by showing Jesus' authority over nature, over demons. And here this morning, in these passages that are kind of wound together and you really can't pull them apart, you also see Jesus' power over sickness and even death. And remember, Luke is trying to get Theophilus to understand that this person, Jesus Christ, that he is being asked to put his faith and trust in, Luke wants him to understand that he is A, trustworthy, but B, has the power to deal with the problems that we all struggle with as human beings. We all struggle with the things that are out of our control. And so Luke wants us to understand, he wants us to see from this passage this morning that two of the things that we fear the most, we fear getting sick. We fear that word cancer or a heart attack or diabetes or whatever it is, we have a fear of that because it's outside of our control to a great extent. And in addition to that, when Dan was preaching a couple of weeks ago, I talked about most of our fears, when you really get down to it, and the anxiety when I talk to people, it's rooted in a fear of death. Now, whether that's their own death or whether it's the death of a loved one, that there is this innate fear that we have inside of us. And we try to start controlling things to compensate for this thing that is outside of our control. And so Luke wants Theophilus to see, but he also wants us to see this morning that when you put your faith in Jesus Christ, you're putting your faith in someone who has mastery over sickness and even death. So let's read this together this morning. It's kind of a long passage that we're going to be reading together as a church. We're going to pick up in verse 40, and let's read it through together as a church. Now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him. There came a man, Jairus, implored him to come to his house, for he had only 12 years of age, was dying. And Jesus went. Discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowds surround you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive the power has gone out from me." When she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared all the people she had touched him, how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble." Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and the mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep. for she is not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, Child, rise. And her spirit returned, and she got up at once, and he directed that something should be given to her to eat. Parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one that had happened. In this passage this morning, we see these two stories that kind of like life are often, you know, we're walking through, we're doing one thing and we get interrupted by something else. And that's kind of what we see here in this passage. We first notice Jesus' positive response in verse 40. If you were here last week, I'm not going to go through all of that again, but if you remember, we ended that story with the people saying, Jesus, get away from us. We don't want you around us. We want you to go away from us. And Luke contrasts that with what happens when he comes back, that there is this crowd that has welcomed him. They're positive. They're looking forward to Jesus being back in their presence. And there's this man, this ruler, Jairus, who is an official of the synagogue. Now, he's kind of like the guy that would probably make the arrangements for synagogue. So he's the guy that would schedule the speaker, the teacher for that day, make sure the order of service was done. The point that I think Luke wants us to see was this was a very devout Jewish man that served God, right? And all of a sudden, now he's coming to Jesus. He came and he fell at his feet and he's pleading with him. Just like we're going to see the hemorrhaging woman, Jairus revealed his faith by coming to Jesus. There's this motion, this direction that we see in both of the people in the story and how they kind of parallel one another is they both have a problem. But they're not just sitting back with that problem going, oh, I've got a problem. God, I wish you would do something about it. Instead, they recognize that the Messiah has come. The Messiah, they believe, is Jesus. And so they're seeking out Jesus for help. And they're coming to him in faith. And so both of these stories, we're seeing the faith of Jairus and this woman with an issue of blood. Verse 43, the scene kind of shifts suddenly. And all of a sudden, we have this woman who gets kind of brought into the spotlight, if you will. And Luke tells us that she's got this issue, this hemorrhaging of blood that's lasted for 12 years. Now, he tells us that, and the fact that she had spent all of her money on physicians to emphasize the severity of her condition, right? This wasn't a woman who just cut her arm and it wouldn't stop bleeding, and she's like, oh, there's Jesus right there. Let me go to him real quick and he can fix this. No, this was a woman who had been suffering for 12 years. And she had exhausted every means possible. Again, Luke wants us to see, he's a physician himself. He wants us to understand who the great physician is. And so he gives us these extra little details in his account to kind of highlight the fact that Jesus has authority and power above and beyond what the average physician has. Even all of the physicians have at this time. This time of 12 years also kind of highlights the hopelessness of her situation when you read that no one could heal her. There's a depression. I don't know if you realize this. I know some of you do from experience. But for those of you who don't, when it comes to a chronic illness, chronic pain, that's the first part of the problem. There's a suffering that comes along with the pain or with the illness. But what also comes along with that after a few years is a mental suffering. That it's never going to get any better. And for some conditions, the reality is it's only going to get worse. And the pain that I'm experiencing today versus the pain that I'm going to experience in 5 years, it's going to be much worse in 5 years. And so there's a mental aspect that comes with suffering that so many times, if you haven't gone through it, if you haven't experienced it, It's easy for you to look at people and just say, suck it up. It's not that big a deal. And we forget that there's a mental hopelessness that comes along with the physical pain. And Luke highlights that here. He wants us to see this is the place that this woman is in as she comes to Jesus. It's interesting here that it says that she comes and touches the hem of his garment. Now, being a Jewish man who's observing the law and living out what God wanted perfectly, Jesus more than likely would have been wearing the traditional garb of a Jewish man, which would have included a prayer shawl. And at the bottom of that would be these little tassels. And sometimes if you know people who are either Messianic Jews or devout Jewish people, you might notice peeking out from their clothes, there's these little tassels that are hanging down. And it's, again, part of their traditional garb that they would wear. It was something it's interesting as if you ever get an opportunity to go to Israel, you see it everywhere. But there's these little tassels that kind of hang out. And she's going to him, and she's believing, okay, this is the Messiah. This is the one that we have been waiting for, the one that has been prophesied about. And one of the ways that we will know that he is the one is there will be healing in his wings. It says in the Old Testament of the Messiah in Malachi that there will be healing in his wings. Now, that might be a weird statement to us because we think about wings. We think about like angels and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, so far from the Bible. But anyway, when you think about a Jewish man who's wearing a prayer shawl or a prayer and he raises his arms, it would appear as though he had wings. And so this woman is coming to Jesus and she's reaching out for the bottom, the hem of his garment, the tassel. I just want to get a touch because there's healing in his wings if he's the Messiah. And she believes that he is. And she has faith and she reaches out and she touches him. And immediately, Luke says, immediately she is healed. 12 years, doctor after doctor after doctor, nothing. And then immediately, she finds healing. It's amazing to see the power that Luke wants us to understand in this passage about Jesus. And the actual question that Jesus asked here is probably a device more than a legitimate question. Jesus knows who touched him. But Jesus wants to call attention to this woman, that this woman who had such faith to reach out and touch the hem of his garment. Now, Peter assumed that this was a somewhat foolish question, right? It's like, come on, there's all these people around. How in the world? Yes, somebody touched you. I mean, lots of people are around you. Lots of people are touching you. But only one person was touching in faith. And so Jesus wants to highlight that. He wants to draw attention to that. So he asked this question. And this woman is fearful. Verse 47, she's trembling, the word says, and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him. Now the Bible doesn't tell us why she was trembling, but a pretty good reason why she was probably trembling can be found in Leviticus chapter 15, verses 19 through 27. And in those passages of the law, you read about the effects of a woman who has an issue of blood, who is hemorrhaging blood. And whenever a person touched or was touched by a woman with an issue of blood, guess what happened? They become unclean, right? And now they would have to go through this process to become clean again. And so Jesus is saying, who is this that touched me, right? This is a devout Jewish woman. She understands what touching a man means, that she's now made him unclean, whether he knows it or not, right? And all of a sudden, now she's caught, right? Like somebody touched me. Someone unclean touched me. Who was it? So yeah, she's a little scared. She's a little nervous here. But notice in verse 48, this is what I love about Jesus, guys. He looked at her, he said to her, daughter. There's a term of affection and endearment here, right? Hey, there's this woman who's terrified. I've made a mistake. You know, like I've come and yes, I got healed, but now I got caught and now I'm in trouble. And what does Jesus do? Does he scold her? Does he yell at her? No, he comforts her. He immediately wants to put her at ease. And he does that by calling her daughter. He says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. So Jesus reassures her. And literally here, what Jesus is saying is your faith has saved you. Not just healed you physically, but it has saved you. And this is what Jesus, I think, is wanting to kind of bring out with this whole dialogue and this whole discussion. Is he's wanting her and the crowd to see that it wasn't just about a physical healing, right? The woman came, she touched, she was healed. She could have walked away and she still would have been healed, right? There's no need for Jesus to call attention to her. But Jesus calls attention to her because he wants her to see that her faith in him not only saved her physically, but is saving her spiritually. Through faith, this woman also received a spiritual healing. And then the story just kind of suddenly shifts back in verse 49. If the daughter were still alive, Jesus might be able to help. But there's this guy who comes and he's like, look, you don't even bother him anymore, right? Like the child in verse 49, while he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore. So obviously there's this servant there that knows that Jairus is trying to get to Jesus and he's trying to get Jesus to help him. But before Jairus can get to that point, the servant comes up and says, look, just don't even waste his time anymore. She's already dead. There's no point in troubling him. There's no point in bothering him, right? Because nobody has the power over death. It's done. It's finished. It's over. It's finished. Then verse 50, but Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, do not fear, only believe, and she will be well. Jesus tells Jairus, you need to believe. The object of the faith here is not described, but we can finish it from what we see in Acts chapter 16, verse 31. Believe in the Lord Jesus, right? And you will be saved. Believe in me. And again, here, we're seeing that this be well is literally saved. Your daughter will be saved if you believe in me. So the story continues, and Jesus goes to the house, and there's this kind of intimate gathering here. We kind of, for the first time, get a peek into the inner circle, if you will, of the 12 disciples in verse 51. And then in verse 52, it comes and it's talking about the weeping and the mourning. And Luke is wanting us to understand that this girl is dead. She's not just sleeping in the sense of like, oh, she fell asleep and everybody's... No, they're wailing and mourning. They're upset. This is what you do when someone dies. And so Jesus' statement here, do not weep, for she is not dead but asleep, is prognosis, not diagnosis. In other words, he's not coming there saying, oh, don't worry, guys, she's just asleep. She'll wake up, I'll wake her up. No, she's dead. She's dead, but because Jesus is there, and because Jairus has put his faith in Jesus, and he's believing that Jesus will save her, we see something amazing happen. Verse 54, child, arise. Literally, get up, right? It's the same term used of raising the widow's son, but it's also the same term used of Jesus' resurrection in Luke 24, 6, right? There's this miracle that happens here. And the Spirit, verse 55, returned, and she got up at once. Again, both the healing of the hemorrhaging of blood and the healing of this woman, there's this, Luke wants us to see this power, this instantaneous nature of this power. And the girl's spirit is what returned here, not the Holy Spirit. And we can kind of see from this passage, there seems to be this distinct spirit that continues to live on after the body is dead. But I want you to understand that's not Luke's point here. Luke's point here is to help us to see and to learn something about Jesus, not about death. The external world, both physical and spiritual, is subject to him, right? Luke wants us to understand by telling us this little detail about her spirit leaving her body and her spirit returning. He wants us to understand, he wants us to see that not only can Jesus physically heal a sickness, not only is he in command of that, but he's also in command of the spiritual realm as well. And that he can tell that spiritual realm, come back, get back in this body, because he is the one who has authority over both the physical and the spiritual. So again, Luke is trying to get Theophilus to see and understand Jesus' power, right? And I talked a lot about that last week, so I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on this week. If you weren't here last week, go back and listen to last week's message. I want to pick up on the second primary thing we see in this passage. And that's the theme of the importance of having faith, right? We see two stories here that through faith, the woman with the hemorrhaging of blood was healed or literally saved and went away in peace. Jairus was also informed that if he believed, healing or salvation would come to his daughter. So Luke is trying to highlight and help us to see with using this term that literally means saved to describe the resurrection of the girl and the woman's healing, that when we, as again it says in Acts 16:31, if we believe in the Lord Jesus, you will be saved. And so Luke wants to highlight in this passage faith. Salvation comes through faith for both the woman and for Jairus. They're both seeking Jesus, and they both are revealing a kind of faith that they have in who Jesus was. So how do we apply this passage? Well, I only have one point of application this morning. Have faith. Have faith. That's what Luke is trying to get Theophilus to understand, is what he's trying to get us to understand this morning, is that we need to have faith. Everybody write that down if you're taking notes. Point number one, have faith. Everybody got it? All right, let's pray. How many times have you heard that sermon? Right? I don't know about you, but I've heard that sermon a lot. And at the end of the sermon, I went, but wait a minute, how do I have faith? What does that look like? Wait, just have faith, right? Well, I can't do that to you this morning. Like, guys, I want to help you to understand how to have faith. It's still my one point, have faith. But I want to look at how the Bible tells us and teaches us to have faith. So how do we have faith? Well, a lot of people think faith is putting your brain on pause, right? It's just like we just have to stop thinking and we just have to trust and we just have to believe blindly something that just doesn't make any sense. And I want you to understand here this morning that even though that's the way faith is often portrayed by the world, That is not the way faith is portrayed by the Bible. That is not what faith wants us to do. Instead, faith consists of, it requires, and it stimulates thinking. Faith isn't the absence of thinking. Instead, I'm going to argue this morning that faith consists of, it requires, and it stimulates our thinking. Faith makes you use your brain. If you're not using your brain, then you're not having faith. You can't have faith without thinking. If you're taking notes, that's a good point right there. You can't have faith without thinking. You can't have real Christian faith without engaging your mind. You said, Dale, how do you know that? Well, let me give you an example. I'm going to show you how we get this example illustrated in this passage, but I think it's a little bit clearer from this passage in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. Where the writer of Hebrews says, "And without faith, it is impossible to please him." Okay, well then how do we do that? "For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him." Now, I think this passage is illustrated well here in Luke chapter 8, right? We have two people who drew near to God. They drew near to Jesus. They believed that he was the Messiah. So that's the first thing this verse is teaching us and telling us as we come to God that we have to first believe that he is real. Right? We have to at least reach the conclusion that there is a God. We have to do that by thinking. Right? Before we're searching him out, before we're believe, we have to know that he exists. And so the Bible is calling us to engage our brain, to open up our eyes, to open up all of our senses, to look at the world around us and make a decision. Come to a conclusion, deduce from logic and the world around us. Is there or is there not a God? Long before you can have faith, you've got to at least come to the conclusion, the reality that there is a God. All right, let me give you an example I think might help you about pursuing and searching after God. There's this beautiful, amazing lake in Guatemala called Lake Atitlan. And this lake is, man, it's almost like a magical place in a way. Like it's this volcanic, it's a volcanic implosion that created this lake that is just miles deep. And all around this volcanic implosion lake is volcanoes all the way around it. So you sit in a boat in the lake and you survey around and all you see in any direction is volcano, volcano, volcano. And it's one of those things that you're just kind of going through Guatemala and there's a bunch of nothing and then all of a sudden it opens up and it's just like, this is paradise. And I tell you about this place, and you say, well, that sounds interesting. I want to visit that place. How many of you would leave here this morning, get in your car, and start driving until you found it? None of you. I would hope none of you would. Why? Because that's irrational. That's illogical. Now, what do we do? Even right now, some of you are already doing it on your phones. You're looking up, where is this Lake Atitlan? Right? Or you would go home and you'd pull it up on your computer and you would research and you would find out where Lake Atitlan is and you would think, okay, this is a place I want to visit. How do I get there? Do I go by car? Do I fly? Do I take a boat? Like, how can I get there? And you start to research and you start to look. So first in your research, what do you do first? You acknowledge and you realize this is a real place. Right? Now that I know that it's a real place, I can make a plan to figure out how to get to this real place. But if I come up here and I start talking to you about some C.S. Lewis book or, you know, Lord of the Rings type thing, and I talking to you about Maldor or, you know, whatever, and you're like, oh, that sounds cool, and you go home, you read, well, that's not real. You don't make plans to go there, do you? No, you make plans to go places that are real. Do you see the point? It's the same way with God. If you don't first come to the conclusion and the reality with your mind that God is real, then it's irrational and illogical to just go wandering around, I'm trying to find God. I'm trying to find him. No, you have to engage your mind. You have to first come to the place to where you understand that there is a God. Now you say, Dale, that's obvious. You can stop beating that horse. Okay, fine. But we got to apply that to God, because what happens, what I see so many times, is people come to church in a crisis. And what they tell me is they want Jesus. We've heard all this stuff about Jesus and we want Jesus. And I say, okay, what do you know that Jesus is true? Do you know that God is true? Well, you see, we live in an age now where people will say this, oh, I know it's true for me. Because it's what I need right now. I'm desperate for anything to help me and to save me. And guys, we do a huge disservice to those people to just continue on with our gospel presentation. Because they're missing a fundamental element of faith. We can't skip over this. You have to believe that God is real, that God is truth. And if you believe that, then that God is the same real truth for everyone, not just you. And so many times, I think in our current climate and our current culture and all the defections that you're seeing amongst the church and sometimes in spectacular ways and sometimes in small ways, what's happened is we've had people come to faith and they've said, well, it feels right to me. It works for me. I don't know that I believe it for everybody, but it works for me. And we as a church have done a bad job of stopping and slowing down and saying, wait, but is it true for everyone? Is this truth truth or is it not? We have to first believe that there is a God. We can't skip over that. God is either objectively true and therefore true for everyone, or he's not. You cannot have it both ways. And this, again, this I feel is the kryptonite that's been embedded in the church in our very gospel presentation, that we don't slow down. We're so excited to see somebody say, yes, I want to follow Jesus, that we never slow down and ask them, but do you believe Jesus is true? Objectionably true, that he is true for everyone. Because when we don't, what happens is we have this very foreign view of faith that we have no room for in Christianity. Christianity makes no room for this kind of faith. We can't have it both ways. So thinking leads to faith. It is true, period. Right? Paul says, we walk by faith and not by sight. Now, what the world likes to say is they like to retranslate that verse and say, well, the church, Christians walk by faith and not by reason. But that's not what Paul says. Paul doesn't say throw out your reason. He doesn't say throw out your thinking. He says, you walk by faith and not by sight. Reasoning and thinking are what faith consists of. You have to have both in your faith. Doubt and unbelief, they're not too much thinking, but I would argue they are too little thinking. Doubt and unbelief aren't too much thinking, but too little thinking. And a loss of faith is not too much thinking, but it's too little thinking. Now, let me give you an example of what I mean by that. Have you ever gone to the dentist and gotten your teeth checked, gotten your teeth cleaned, right? And the dentist comes in and they've taken x-rays and he sits down and he's like, okay, Mr. Tompkins, clearly you haven't been brushing as well as you should be, and you've got these cavities, and we need to, the best course of action, he pulls up the x-ray, he shows me the hole in my tooth, and he's like, okay, what we have to do is we need to do a root canal, and then after the root canal, it's so far, we just need to put a crown on it, and that's going to protect your mouth and your bite and your teeth and all that kind of stuff, and this is what you need to do. And you sit there and you listen, and you think about it, and you look at the evidence that the dentist is presenting to you, and you go, you know what? You're right. That's exactly what I need to do. If I don't do anything, it's going to continue to rot. It'll rot my jaw. I don't need to do that. So you make the decision. They go ahead and schedule the appointment. Say, okay, we're going to schedule you in 2 days. You come back. We'll have you all ready. We'll do the procedure, put a temporary crown on, all the deal. You got all the evidence. You talk to other people, and you're like, man, this is the best plan. This is what I should do. That's what I should do. But what happens? You come back to the office for the procedure and you sit down in the chair and you look over. Don't ever look over. When you're at the dentist, just keep looking forward. Little piece of advice, right? But you look over to this table and you see these needles. These really long needles, right? And you see this drill, and you're like, why does he have power tools? Like, what? When did Ryobi start making dentist tools? This is crazy, right? He's going to start drilling on me. And what happens? You start to have fear and doubt. Is this now the best plan of action? Now that I'm looking at this, is this really what I should be doing? You see all these things, and doubt starts to come in. Where does the doubts come from? New evidence? New reasoning? No, they're coming from sight. And so when Paul says we walk by faith and not by sight, he's telling us something incredibly important. He's not saying throw out your reasoning and thinking, right? Because that's what faith consists of. We walk by faith. We walk by reasoning and thinking, not by sight, not by fear. I'm losing my faith because of my emotions, not because of my reasons, my reasoning, not because of my thinking, but because of my emotions, because of fear. So as I'm sitting there in the chair, what do I need to do to prepare myself for not only the sight of the drill, but the sound of the drill, right? I need to renew my thinking. So what do? I think back through the evidence. Okay, I've got a big hole in my teeth. If I don't do anything about this tooth, it's eventually going to rot. And then it's eventually going to affect my bone. It's going to go into my bone and cause jaw decay. Right? Okay, so based on the evidence, even though the sight of all of that emotionally is not pleasing, what I'm thinking and what I'm reasoning is the best course of action is still the best course of action. The truth, in other words, is still the truth. Our doubts and our fears, I would argue this morning, come from an absence of thinking. They come from just reacting, not from thinking and reasoning. Another example of this, if a doctor came to you and he told you, hey, you're one step away from diabetes. If you keep eating all that cake and all those sweets, you are going to end up being diabetic. And the doctor pulls out your A1C, and for those of you who don't know yet, you will one day. Your A1C is your three-month blood glucose level, and they kind of show you your average of what your blood glucose is. Because sometimes you can fool the doctor, right? You know, you go to the doctor that one day, and it's like, look, my blood glucose is normal. But they have this test, and they can look and see. Now, you've been bad. You've been eating lots of cakes and sweets. And so he shows you the evidence. He lays it all out for you. You talk to other people who have diabetes, and they all tell you the same thing. Yeah, we had to cut back on this, and we had to cut back on this. So you reason, and with your thinking, you believe what the doctor tells you. And you're like, okay, I agree. The best course of action for me, no more sweets. But what happens the first time you come face to face with a delicious piece of cake? Your thinking and your reasoning goes out the window, right? You're overwhelmed by your emotions. Oh, that looks so good. And you just want to jump in, and you just want to grab a hold of it and eat it all. And that's when things get bad, right? You see, in that moment, what's happening? In that moment that you're looking at the most delicious piece of cake you've ever seen in your life. I don't know why after the doctor tells you you can't have something. You guys probably experienced this. If the doctor says you can't have something, all of a sudden that something is the best thing in the world. You didn't even think about it last week, but now it's all you can think about, right? Hey, you need to cut back on your salt intake. What? Yes, okay, that's fine. No big deal. I want salt, right? You need to cut back on your sugar intake. Oh man, I just really want some sugar. I'm jonesing for some sugar, right? Right? We understand that objectively what the doctor is saying is true. But in the presence of whatever that thing is that we're not allowed to have, it no longer feels true, right? And this is how we convince ourselves to eat the cake. Because while what the doctor said is objectively true, in the moment, it doesn't feel true. Guys, this is why we cannot skip the step of seeing that God is objectively true for everyone. Otherwise, what happens when things get bad in your life? Right? If you're one of those people and you came to Jesus because it just feels right, just feels good. I'm in the midst of some chaos, and man, I could really use some help right now. And yeah, you know, as a pastor, I'm looking, I'm going, yeah, Jesus can help you. Jesus is ultimately the answer for you. But if you don't understand that Jesus is objectively true, what happens when things get bad? I mean, I think we see it in the church today. You walk away. You lose your faith. Why? Because of thinking and reasoning? Because the objective truths about God have changed? No. No, because it doesn't feel true anymore. So what happens when our feelings change? And they will, guys. They will. Why? Well, because things that are true don't always feel true. In the same way that you can sit there and listen to that doctor, and the doctor says, this is what you got to do. And you're like, yes, that is what I've got to do. But then you're faced with that piece of cake and you're like, it doesn't feel true anymore. It feels like I can have a few bites of that cake and it'll be fine. But it's still objectively true. And this is why when we talk about faith, we're not talking about feelings. We're not talking about just blindly going, okay, I just trust there's God out there. No, no. Engage the brain. Faith requires reasoning and thinking and finding objective truth. We need more thinking, not less thinking. Think about what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6. Here, he's addressing these people who are anxious and worried and upset. And they're like, man, where's this going to come from? And what does Jesus say? Does Jesus say, just have faith. Just blindly follow me. No, he tells them to engage their brains. How does he do that? He says, look, consider the lilies. Use your brain. Look at the lilies. Understand in your brain with reasoning, you're more valuable than the lilies to God. And if he clothes the lilies, surely he will clothe you. That's not just blind, bleep, bleep, bleep. No, it's engage your brain. Think. Reason. Some of you are here this morning, you're like, man, I just wish I had more faith. Think. Engage what God has given you between your two ears. Because faith consists of thinking and reason. It's how our faith grows. Jesus tells them, deduce, look around you. Look at the world. What Jesus and Luke are saying is that people with little or no faith are people that just react instead of think. Or they are people that let their emotions override their thinking. Or they're people that let their circumstances control them and keep them from thinking. But guys, this morning I want you to walk away and understand and hear loud and clear, faith is grounded in thinking. It takes thinking to have faith. So why do I say that faith or that thinking leads to faith? Well, again, when we're reasoning, we use our brains that our faith leads us to see that the God who invented the world is not some impersonal force, but he's a person. That there is a person that created this world. Notice what he says happens in the second part of that verse I read to you from Hebrews 11:16. For whoever would draw near to God must first believe that he exists. You have to engage your thinking, right? Now, when you do that, notice what follows. And that he rewards those who seek him. Again, I think we see this beautifully illustrated in Luke's passage this morning. Here's two people that sought after God. And they were both saved. And guys, listen, some of you are here this morning, and I know because of your circumstances, you get hung up on the she was healed and this person came back from the dead. But the bigger point that he was trying to make was their salvation, their spiritual healing. That loved one that you've lost, that you're probably maybe a little mad at God about, if they were in Jesus Christ, they're going to live again in a glorious resurrected body, never to struggle with sickness, ever again. And yeah, I know it's not now, but that's the objective truth. And our circumstances can't change or dictate the way we think about objective truth. Now, our feelings can, but not our thoughts. This is a person that has created the world, and he wants you to seek him. This is somebody that wants a relationship with you this morning. And if this is true, this should lead our thinking and our reasoning to this next logical conclusion, which is, what and how do I please him? If there is this personal God who has created the world, including me, then what do I need to do to please him? The Bible tells us that if you don't let your thinking take you ultimately to Jesus Christ, like the woman and Jairus here in this passage, that it will lead you to despair. If you don't let your thinking first realize there is a God, second that he is personal and wants a relationship with us, third, if we're going to please this God, how do we please this God? If you go via any other route than Jesus Christ, if you go by trying to live the law of the Old Testament, if you go by trying to be a good person, if you go via any other route than Jesus Christ, it will end in despair and hopelessness. You know why? Because the Bible tells us that there is only one way to please God. Just one. When John baptized Jesus, we read about the only person in history that lived a perfect life and whom the Bible records that God was well pleased with. And then in Romans 8, when we believe in Jesus and we receive the Spirit comes down on us and tells us that we are God's children too, and that we are well pleasing, because we have put our faith in the one who was perfect and well-pleasing. And that is the only way that we can please God. I would argue this morning, if you would engage your brain and start thinking more, your thinking will lead you to see that there is a God. It will lead you to see that he's a personal God. And eventually your thinking will have to get to this place of, how can I please this God? And again, if you take any other route but Jesus Christ, you will be miserable, because he is the only one that has ever pleased God. The one that said that I died on the cross and I rose again, and if you believe in me, all that I have done is credited to you. And that my Father then looks at you as though he's looking at me. That's the only way we can please God this morning. If you're here this morning and you're convinced that there is a God, guys, don't stop there. It's not enough to just be convinced that there is a God. Keep pressing and keep going until you get to the place that you see that he wants to have a relationship with you, that he is a personal God, not just some force out in the galaxy somewhere. And maybe you're here this morning and you're wondering, am I pleasing this personal God? Don't stop thinking until you see that it is only in Jesus Christ that you can ever please God. Those of you who are Christians here this morning, why are you afraid? Why are you worried? Why are you anxious? You know why? Because you stopped thinking. And you've started reacting. You stopped thinking and reasoning on the objective truths of God's word. And instead, you're just reacting to your emotions and to your circumstances. My charge to you this morning is to start thinking again. We need more thinking. Don't say this morning, Lord, just give me faith and expect it to like abstractly fall out of heaven for you. No, instead, this morning, get out the truth. Review it. Go through it. Think about it. Reason with it. Engage with it. Renew your thinking. The same way you have to do when you're in the dentist chair and you're looking over at all this stuff and you're scared and you're like, okay, I got to think about what is true. This morning, if you want to have more faith, renew your thinking. And if you're here this morning and you're afraid, you're bitter, you're discouraged, don't say, man, I just wish God would zap me with faith like other people. Don't say that. Jesus says to us, look to heaven and think. Consider the lilies. Consider creation. Consider how intricate everything in our world, how dependent everything is upon all everything. It's mind-blowing. It's hard for me to read about science and the natural world and not be led to a creator. And that's not because I'm disengaging my thinking. It's because I'm engaging my thinking. There's no way you can tell me this is an accident. I just can't find, that takes way more faith than believing in a personal God who's created everything you see, that wants to have a relationship with you this morning. So if you're here this morning and you're struggling and you say, oh, Dale, I don't have enough faith. Here's how to have faith. Renew your thinking. Start thinking about the objective truths of God's word. Focus on them. Think about them. Meditate on them. Dwell on them. Reason with them. And watch your faith grow. Let's pray. Father,